From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Kim Philby was a master spy. He rose to the upper ranks of British intelligence, all the while working as a double agent for the Soviets. Philip Knightley conducted a series of interviews with Philby shortly before Philby's death last year. On today's Fresh Air, Knightley talks about the notorious double agent. Also today, Amos Walker, a tough private eye in a tough town, Detroit. We talk with the author of the Amos Walker detective stories, Lauren Esselman. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews current albums from three L.A. bands. And critic at large Laurie Stone reviews Lipsinka. That's the stage name of John Epperson, a New York actor whose one-man show features drag impressions of Connie Francis and Carmen Miranda. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Kim Philby was arguably the most remarkable spy in the history of espionage. He rose through the ranks of Britain's Secret Intelligence Service to become the head of counterintelligence and the British liaison to the FBI and the CIA. But all that time, Philby was really on assignment for the KGB. He was a Soviet spy with the mission of penetrating British intelligence, a mission at which he was remarkably successful. Philby defected to the Soviet Union in 1963. My guest Philip Knightley conducted a series of interviews with Philby a month before Philby's death in May of 1988. Knightley was the last journalist to interview Philby and the only Western journalist to interview him in depth since his defection. Philip Knightley was a special correspondent for the London Sunday Times for over 20 years and is the author of a history of 20th century espionage called The Second Oldest Profession. His new book is a biography of Philby based on their interviews, called The Master Spy. Knightley told me why he wanted to talk with Philby.
Back in 1967, I was a member of a Sunday Times team of reporters, Sunday Times of London, that is, who had reconstructed Kim Philby's life by talking to people who knew him. But the problem of such a reconstruction and writing a biography about the person is that you never get a full, rounded picture of the man himself. And I was absolutely fascinated, not so much by Philby's treachery and not so much by what details of what he'd given away to the Soviet Union, but his motivations and his psychology and his beliefs and his politics. So I started writing to him, and over a 20-year period, I suppose we exchanged three or four letters each year. And in those letters, I would say, come on, Mr. Philby, time's passing. Isn't it time that you let me come to Moscow and have a chat with you? And he resolutely would reply, no, don't like the press, don't want to talk to newspaper men, nothing to say, they won't let me, etc., etc. And then suddenly, late in 1967, I got a letter that said, if you'd care to come with just you and your notebook, no tape recorders and no television cameras, hate television, he said, I can't stand, takes away all the dignity from solemn occasions. Then maybe there is a possibility in the near future that we might be able to have a long chat. And a couple of weeks later, I got a telegram saying, come to Moscow.
And when was this?
This was in January 1988, just a little over 18 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were criticized by some of your colleagues or former colleagues in the London Sunday Times, who they said that, listen, if he wants to tell his propaganda, let him tell it to his Vestia or Pravda.
Indeed.
What made you think that he was going to be honest with you?
Well, I had no guarantee he was going to be honest with me. The actual criticism was, why make a journalistic pilgrimage to Moscow? If Philby wants to talk to tell his story, let him tell it to Vestia Pravda. My answer to that was that every one of those journalists who made such a criticism would have gone like a shot himself.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know whether he's going to be honest or not. I didn't know what would happen, but you have to be there to find out. Of course, to this day, I don't know whether he's 100% right. Honest with me. I don't know whether there was some disinformation sowed in that. I mean, one of the criticisms that CIA officers make, I heard of one who had said, the KGB played Knightley beautifully, but if they were playing me, what was the game? Nobody's yet been able to explain to me what the game might have been.
Was there any resistance either in England or the Soviet Union to your trip?
He must have got clearance from the KGB, although he did say to me that they weren't entirely happy with the idea of me being there. And I think there may have been resistance in other quarters in the Soviet Union, because, believe it or not, here is this man, a senior officer, a general in what's said to be one of the most powerful intelligence services in the world. And when I was leaving, he said to me, oh, by the way, if there's any trouble at the airport and they take away your notes, I'll do my best to get them back for you. Now, I never quite found out who they were, but I suspect it was the militia. And I think there was some rivalry between the militia and the KGB. And he couldn't be certain that I would be allowed to leave the Soviet Union with the notes that I had of our interview.
Do you think that your interview was bugged?
I asked him that question, and he said, I don't know and I don't care. He said, I suspect not, because it's no good bugging somebody unless you're prepared to play back those hours and hours of tapes and transcribe them and read them and try and make some sense of them. I suspect that they probably bugged these particular interviews I had with him just for the record. And I suspect the reason he wouldn't let me take a tape recorder was that he didn't want another record apart from the official one.
Speaking with Philip Knightley about his new biography of Kim Philby called The Master Spy. Now, you said you were most interested in what his motivations were for becoming a Soviet spy. He was recruited in, I think it was 1934, while he was at Cambridge.
Yes.
What did you find out about his motivations for turning?
Well, he was 21 years of age at the time, you know, and that's pretty young. And he said he looked around him. He'd studied at Cambridge. He'd studied economics and history. And he looked around him and he decided that, as he put it, quote, the world, the poor of this world had it too damn bad for too damn long, and the rich had it too good for too damn long. And he said the question then became, once I'd made that decision, what I was to do about it. And he felt he should do something about it. You know, he's one of those Englishmen who wants to be involved. Politics are part of his life. So he said, I also looked around me and I saw that Britain was a class-ridden society, that fascism was on the march in Europe and the Far East, and that nobody seemed to be prepared to stand up to it. In fact, some of the leaders of Britain seemed quite content with the idea that eventually Britain might be a fascist state. So he said, I looked at the established British parties, and they didn't appear to be bothered or doing anything about it. I looked at the established European parties, the Social Democrats. They didn't appear to be an effective bulwark against the rise of fascism. And all I could find in the world at that time, prepared to make a stand against the rise of the fascist world, was the Soviet Union. So he said, I made my commitment to the Soviet Union, and I stuck with it right throughout the worst of Stalinism, right throughout the show trials, and I remained a faithful communist to the last of my days.
Of course, it's one thing to oppose fascism, and it's another thing to sell out your own country.
Yes, he says, I betrayed no one. From the moment I made that commitment, I was a serving member of the Soviet intelligence service. And as such, my assignment was to pretend to be something I wasn't and to penetrate British intelligence. Now, if they were foolish enough to fall for my pose, then that's their lookout.
What was his pose?
That he was a typical middle-class English son of a civil servant who was interested in entering the British intelligence world and making a career out of it.
Now, why were they interested in admitting him? Do you think he had a particular talent for spying? He really rose pretty quickly in intelligence.
He did, indeed. Well, he rose quickly because he was recruited in wartime and they were desperately short of people who had any ability. The march of the Germans across Europe had rolled up most of the British intelligence network in Europe. There was the old and decrepit leadership at home had no new or bright ideas. They recruited him because he'd come to their attention in Spain, where he'd been a war correspondent, and because his father knew somebody in the service, and this person in the service recommended him. And this person went back to the office after a lunch with Kim and said, I've got a marvelous new recruit for him. For us, I knew his father in India. That's the way recruiting was done in Britain in the intelligence services in those days.
One of the really amazing things that Philby did was to rise and become the head of counter-espionage.
Yes.
In England. I mean, imagine a Soviet spy heading up counter-espionage.
Well, at the end of the war, the powers that be in the Foreign Office looked around at who was who in British intelligence, and they noticed Philby's career during the war. They rewarded him with an OBE, quite a high decoration, and they kept him on. The only civilian employed by British intelligence during the war who was kept on after the war. And they had a job for him. That's why they kept him on. They wanted him to move from the Iberian subpeninsula, where he'd been doing counter-espionage work, to become head of Section 9, which had been set up late in 1944, to conduct aggressive intelligence operations against the Soviet Union. So the man, as you say, who was in head of British intelligence department handling aggressive intelligence operations against the Soviet Union, was himself a Soviet agent.
Did Philby tell you anything about the kind of ongoing communications he had with the KGB while he was heading up counterintelligence in England?
No, he was very careful not to reveal what he called KGB operational methods that might still be valid. But we know that he had regular, if infrequent, contact with his KGB control, the man who inspired him in the first place, who explained to him what dedication the job would need. As for the actual day-by-day communication, although I don't think it did take place day-by-day, I think Philby met as rarely as possible so that there would be no chance of him being exposed, at which he passed on information of long-term strategic significance to the Soviet Union, he would not talk about.
Now, one of the things he did while he headed up counterintelligence in England was to change the section from purely defensive to intelligence gathering. What was his motivation for doing that? Did he explain?
Yes, he did. He said the aim of British or all Western intelligence operations against the Soviet Union in the early days of the Cold War, which as far as the intelligence service, Western intelligence services were concerned, began before the actual end of the war, were to try to splinter away various outposts of the Soviet Empire and swing them into the Western camp. Now, this involved dropping of agents prepared to commit sabotage, murder, and subversion in those countries to set up safe houses, to expand networks and things like that. And Philby claimed that the best way of doing this was to conduct, not to just to remain passive and wait to see what the Soviet Union did, but to actually push these operations as far as was possible. Of course, all these operations failed miserably because Philby had betrayed the general outlines of the plan to Moscow before they even began.
Did he tell you anything about how he operated in that position? And how he could intentionally undermine the British intelligence?
Yes, I mean, he was vague on actual details, but he said that he'd ran an operation in 45 and 46 from Sweden into Latvia, inserting into genuine Latvian refugees returning home from Sweden a number of SIS, British intelligence, recruited agents whose job it was to set up safe houses, collect arms, and train people for sabotage missions. And he'd personally taken charge of such an operation, I think probably just to learn the details of what happened, you know, and how it worked. But though the Soviet intelligence service was very careful not to use him for fairly low-level stuff, you know, nuts and bolts details of intelligence, in case they had exposed a man that they, or risk exposure, a man that they eventually hoped would be head of the whole British intelligence system.
What's the extent of the damage that he was responsible for in British intelligence?
Well, if you take his whole career from 41 until 51, when he was negated or neutralized, I think it splits fairly equally into neatly into two parts. There was the services that he could render the Soviet Union during the war, which were also valuable. Three parts, let's make it, which were also valuable to Britain. In other words, his straight counterintelligence work in Spain and Portugal that made it difficult for German intelligence to penetrate Britain. That was of equal value to Britain as the Soviet Union, so he saw absolutely no conflict and duty in what he was doing. Then he had a secret role in assisting the Soviet Union to keep abreast of developments in Britain, which Moscow was worried might lead to a separate peace between Germany, United States and Britain, and a switching of the war away from Germany to a combined front against the Soviet Union, where at the moment that that was first considered, the Germans stood on the brink of success. The Soviet Union was absolutely paranoid about such a possibility, remembering the Allied intervention in Russia just after the Bolshevik Revolution, when something like 26 countries were desperately trying to put down Lenin and Trotsky and the whole Bolshevik movement. So they'd set up Philby in a position in British intelligence to keep them advised against any repeat of history there. That was an important information service he was able to provide the Soviet Union. Then on a practical level, he was able to divert or downgrade any attempts for the separate peace which came from Germany. I mean, German peace feelers had to come through neutral countries. They usually came through Spain and Portugal. They passed across Philby's desk, and he had to evaluate how genuine these offers were. And he would routinely say that they weren't genuine offers, they were probably a provocation, that the source had passed them on was unreliable, and so these papers were never circulated. You could, by stretching it a little, say that in doing this, chances for an earlier end to the war were probably lost. Now, then the second part of, or the third part of his role was when he was at the heart of Western intelligence in the whole Western intelligence effort against the Soviet Union during his posting to Washington when he was CIA liaison officer with the FBI and the CIA.
This is in 1949 that he comes to the stage.
49 to 51. When he was able to tell Moscow, keep Moscow abreast of all the long-term strategic aims the covert action that both services were waging against the Soviet Union.
Did he tell you about any close calls when he thought he was close to blowing his cover?
He had two, one in Spain, when the Spanish police nearly got him, and at a time during the Spanish Civil War when the punishment for espionage was being put against the wall and shot immediately. He was nearly caught with some Soviet one-time code pads in his pocket. This was because he was foolishly carrying them around with him, and he'd gone on a trip, and he'd found himself in an area for which he didn't have a pass, and the Spanish police asked him to empty his pockets. And, of course, if they'd found that on him, then he was finished. His career as a Soviet spy would have been over virtually before it began. But he managed to wriggle out of that by throwing his wallet, when they asked him to empty his pockets, violently onto the desk so it skidded off and fell to the floor. And while the policemen were bending over to pick it up, he quickly slipped the piece of paper from his pocket and swallowed it. The other occasion was in 1945 when there was a defector, a Soviet defector in Istanbul, called Volkov, who volunteered to come over to the West and offered us his little menu of titbits that he would provide Western intelligence once his visa and payment of money had been made to him. And among those titbits was the names of three members of the Foreign Service. And don't forget the SIS comes under British Foreign Service, Foreign Office. The names of three Foreign Office officers who were actual Soviet agents. The other two were Burgess and MacLean, and the third was clearly Philby. But the agent was not about to reveal this until the details of his defection had been arranged. And while it was going to take about a week or so Volkov left the British consulate, making arrangements for meetings in a week's time. Now, the information was quickly relayed to London, where the head of British intelligence said, "This is a defector of utmost importance, and I'm going to put my best man on the job." And he put on the job, guess who? Our old friend Kim Philby. So Philby, before leaving for Istanbul to interview this defector, who knew Philby's name but not what he looked like, but was in a perfect position to blow Philby's cover, made a call to Moscow, and by the time that he arrived there to interview the defector had mysteriously disappeared.
Hmm. Well, I want to talk with you about Philby's own defection, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is British journalist Philip Knightley, who's written a new biography of Kim Philby. It's called The Master Spy. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is British journalist Philip Knightley. His new book, The Master Spy, is based on a series of interviews he conducted with Kim Philby last year in the Soviet Union, a month before Philby died. Knightley has also written a history of spying called The Second Oldest Profession. For more than 20 years, he was a special correspondent for the London Sunday Times. How was Philby's cover finally blown?
Well, in 1951, the man Burgess that I just mentioned to you, and MacLean, the other two of the three who would have been named by this defector if he'd ever made it to Britain. MacLean was coming under suspicion for the passing of certain information that had been available to him in his role as first secretary in the British Embassy in the immediate post-war period. And MacLean had undergone such worry and nervous tension over this that it was thought by his Moscow control that he would be unable to withstand interrogation. And the decision was taken that he should get out of Britain and defect to the Soviet Union. Burgess was to help him in this escape, but not to go himself. Unknown to Philby and Philby's control in Washington, Burgess decided that he would go too, because he too was at the end of his nervous energy tether. And instead of just MacLean going, and again I stress unknown to Philby and Philby's KGB control, Burgess went as well. Now, this immediately compromised Philby because Philby had had Burgess living with him in his house in Washington, a very bad tradecraft for the KGB and one of their major blunders because it blew a 30-year-long operation to get Philby into the position of being head of British intelligence. Once Burgess and McLean had gone, people in Washington, notably J. Edgar Hoover, said, "Hey, wait a minute, there's something funny here. Burgess has been living with Philby. Philby is supposed to be the world's greatest counterintelligence officer. Now, either he isn't the world's greatest counterintelligence officer, so what is he? Or he has been involved in Burgess's escape himself." So from that moment on, General Walter Beadle Smith, the head of the CIA, and J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, cut off all relations with Britain, British intelligence, until such time as Philby was gone.
Was it difficult for him to get out and get to the Soviet Union?
That came later. At this stage, in 51, all that happened was that he, because of the cutting off of relations until Philby was got rid of, Philby was recalled to Britain, given a sort of kangaroo court trial, a sort of fake trial in the offices of SIS to see what sort of evidence could be mounted against him that might stand some chance of convicting him in a court of law. He withstood that interrogation and that fake trial brilliantly. So because there was no possibility of employing him again, he, due to pressure from America, he had to go, and he was pensioned off and paid off with a lump sum. But then about 4 years later, under pressure again, at this time from J. Edgar Hoover, who'd mounted a little undercover publicity operation to get Philby exposed, the British government was forced to make a statement which, instead of, as Hoover had hoped, would have announced that Philby was the third man who tipped off Burgess and McLean about their impending interrogation, because there was not enough evidence to make that stand up in the statement, the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary Harold Macmillan, had to say that actually there was no evidence that Philby had indeed been a Soviet spy or the third man. In other words, Philby was cleared. That gave him another valuable 8 years because his friends saying, "Ha-ha, here it is, Philby cleared, he was the victim of McCarthyism, let's find him a freelance job. And they found him a freelance job as a journalist, and he worked out of Beirut for the next 8 years. And at the end of those 8 years, when evidence from elsewhere, namely that from a Soviet defector called Galitzin, arrived and put the final marks on Philby's treachery, he had to get out of town, and he left and went home to Moscow, as he puts it.
Really a remarkable career of deceit. You visited him in the Soviet Union, the only Western journalist to have an interview with him there. How did he seem to be treated by Soviets and by the government, by the KGB, by his neighbors? I mean, do you have a lot of stature when you're when you've been a mole for so many years and
indeed,
then you defect to the Soviet Union?
Indeed. So you have to understand that a defector, Philby may be considered a traitor and a defector and to have betrayed his country in Western terms, but in Soviet terms, he was a hero. And I know this because of the awards that he won, as I said, Order of the Red Banner and Order of the Order of Lenin, the sort of apartment he occupied, a very large three-bedroom apartment in the heart of Moscow with inside of the Kremlin walls, the privileges he had, a chauffeur-driven black car anytime he wanted to go anywhere, a house in the country, freedom to travel anywhere within the Soviet bloc and even overseas. He visited Cuba on one occasion. So it was clear to me that he was well thought of by the authorities. I don't think his neighbors knew who he was. I mean, they knew that he was not Russian-born, and they knew that he probably had something to do with the government. But exactly who he was, I don't think his neighbors knew.
You don't suspect he ever had any remorse?
Remorse, regret, we discussed this. He said that at one stage he felt that he'd made the wrong choice during that Brezhnev period and that he took to drinking a lot and was drinking on suicidal binges, but that the arrival of a new woman in his life, a half-Russian, half-Polish woman called Rufa, to whom he was married at the time of his death, an increased use of him by the KGB when Andropov, his ex-boss, took over as First Secretary of the Communist Party, and the arrival on the scene finally of Gorbachev, a leader who he felt he'd been waiting for all his life, made him absolutely unregretful, without remorse, proud of his life and its achievements, and he died a happy and contented man.
Is it harder now to write about espionage in England? And I'm thinking of you know, in the light of attempts to censor the Spycatcher book.
Yes, well, there were attempts to censor my book as well. We had my publisher had a letter from the head of the DNOS committee, which offers, quote, voluntary, unquote, advice to publishers and newspapers about what they should and should not print, asking to see an advance copy of the manuscript. And my publisher, with some vigor, replied that he was not accustomed to submitting things for pre-censorship. And the denotice man went away. But he will not go away as easily later this year when the Official Secrets Act steadily making its way through the British Parliament comes into power, because it makes an offence for the unauthorised disclosure of anything which might harm British interests abroad or damage international relations. And the definition of harm and damage in both cases is that what is defined by the British government.
Do you think embarrassment might come under that heading?
Yeah, of course. I mean, they're much more likely under the heading of harm than anything else you could probably think of.
What is the most surprising thing that Philby had to tell you?
Surprising? He didn't surprise me much because I...
Or the story that puts his... The story he told a Jew that puts his story in a new light.
The saddest thing he told me was to say that he was two people, a political person and a private person, and that he always put, when the two clashed, then his political persona always won out. That he would sacrifice wife, family, children, and everything for his political beliefs. And I said I couldn't understand anybody feeling so strongly about politics being prepared to do that. And he said, well, that's the sort of person I am. I mean, that was surprising because we parted ways there. I suppose the single most surprising thing was his obvious admiration for Mrs. Thatcher. And I puzzled over this for a long while, and it occurred to me that the reason is that he admired strong political views strongly held, and that it didn't matter that much to him that maybe political views from the opposite side of the political spectrum as he had, but the fact that they were strongly held, I think he felt, went some way to justifying his own stance.
Philby died about a month after you interviewed him.
Yes, I had nothing to do with it.
But that, do you think of that as just being coincidence, or is there any mysterious circumstances surrounding his death?
No mysterious circumstances. I discussed this at length with his widow. He'd been ill several times. He'd had what, in retrospect, were clearly minor strokes. He led a vigorous and nerve and enervating life. He was a heavy drinker and a heavy smoker. And I think it all just caught up with him. And don't forget, he was 76, which is not a bad innings.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. I've enjoyed it.
My guest has been Philip Knightley. His new book, The Master Spy, about Kim Philby, is published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with actor Gary Oldman. He played punk rocker Sid Vicious in the film Sid and Nancy, and gay playwright Joe Orton in Prick Up Your Ears. He co-stars with Kevin Bacon in the new film Criminal Law. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Private Eye Amos Walker knows what it's like to ride in a cop car, to be at the scene of a murder, to be knocked out cold. So does his creator, Lauren Esselman. Coming up, Lauren Esselman talks about writing the hard-boiled Amos Walker detective novels. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker samples albums from three groups coming out of the Los Angeles music scene, including the post-punk band Thelonious Monster and the West Coast rap band N.W.A. And Laurie Stone comments on an art form that she thinks has traditionally been used to insult women, female impersonation. Laurie says the act of New York-based drag performer John Epperson is an exception. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. House Speaker Jim Wright today got a jump on the House Ethics Committee and announced he never knowingly or intentionally violated House rules. The ethics panel is scheduled to vote later in the day to pursue some of the charges against Wright. The speaker is accused of improperly accepting gifts from a business partner and trying to skirt the rules governing outside income limits. Wright said he's asked to appear before the committee to answer the charges, saying that he can demonstrate in each instance that no rule has been violated. The bloodiest incident since the Palestinian uprising began a year and a half ago took place today. As NPR's John Hockenberry reports, the events unfolded in an isolated village on the West Bank.
Until today, the West Bank village of Nahalin had not had a fatality during the 17-month Palestinian uprising. What happened this morning in the village is being described as a massacre by residents. All week long, Israeli border police have been entering the village in the pre-dawn hours. Palestinians say to harass residents. The army says to respond to Palestinian provocations. Between the hours of 5 a.m. and 9:30 local time this morning, at least five Palestinians were killed by live ammunition, one of the bloodiest days of the uprising. According to Nahalin residents, border police shot indiscriminately at villagers, entered the village mosque during prayers, and chased wounded people into the woods around the village. Some villagers were unaccounted for as of this evening, according to residents. The Israeli army says that four Palestinians died today and 11 were wounded. And the army says it has launched a full investigation into the Nahalin incident. This is John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
The defense rested today in the criminal trial of Oliver North. During today's court proceedings, North explained how he tried to deceive investigators looking into whether he had received an illegal gift. On his sixth and final day of testimony, North said he typed letters on typewriters displayed at a store in December 1986 after he'd been fired from the National Security Council. The backdated letters made it appear as though North had intended to pay for a $14,000 home security system. North accepted the elaborate system from retired Air Force Major General Richard Secord. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney, who's in the final stages of paring down the Pentagon budget, today gave a broad outline of his plans for achieving $6 billion in cuts. NPR's David Malpas reports.
In an interview with network television correspondent, Secretary Cheney said, as things stand now, some weapon systems will be eliminated and the size of the military will be smaller. Cheney said the cuts are tough and some will be controversial. He declined to give details, saying the process is still under review.
There are some instances where, in fact, I've gone to force reductions. So those are all tentative decisions. They're not final yet. The services have the opportunity to appeal.
In another interview, Cheney said he favors production delays for some new high-tech weapons, hinting that the B-2 stealth bomber might be among them. Cheney says SDI funding could be cut, but he also says if the research proves fruitful, the U.S. should deploy a missile defense and withdraw from the 1972 ABM treaty. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
Drexel Burnham Lambert today reached agreement with the Securities and Exchange Commission to settle its security fraud charges. The SEC has charged Drexel, the former head of its junk bond department, Michael Milken, and several others with a long list of securities violations, including insider trading. Drexel agreed to plead guilty to six related felonies to avoid an indictment for racketeering. The plea agreement in the criminal case cannot become final until Drexel settles a civil case that was also brought by the SEC. Retail sales only rose 0.1% last month. Slow car sales get much of the blame for the sluggish showing. Stock prices fell sharply on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 23 points to close at 22.96. Declines led advances 9-4 on a volume of 142 million shares. The average price of a share in New York lost 25 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Los Angeles may be the capital of the recording industry, but the local music scene doesn't necessarily get a lot of national attention. Rock critic Ken Tucker surveys the scene with records by three Los Angeles groups. This is Thelonious Monster.
Drink some beer, smoke some pot, snort some coke, and then drive over 55.
In the 70s, the pop cultural cliche about the Los Angeles music scene used to be that it was the world headquarters for laid-back music, the center of self-indulgence, the place where soft rock acts like Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Browne, and the Eagles made their greatest hits. This was never really true. Any place that managed to nurture both Neil Young and Randy Newman can't be accused of being very laid back. And it became even less true in the early 80s when punk rock hit L.A. very hard. These days, no particular school of music dominates the pop scene in L.A., but instead of being aimless, this makes the town more interesting than it's ever been. It's terrific, for example, that a city as consumed with show business could have yielded an act as casually non-showbiz as Green on Red. Green on Red is led by Dan Stewart and Chuck Prophet, whose idea of a good rock album is one that sounds as if it was recorded on the first take, with improvised melodies and lyrics. They make an art out of sloppiness. Green on Red's new album, called Here Come the Snakes, includes what I think may well be the best Rolling Stones ripoff I've ever heard, a song called Keith Can't Read. Another aggressively eclectic outfit is Thelonious Monster, led by lead singer Bob Forrest. Forrest grew up in Huntington Beach, an area that produced a number of notably crude hardcore punk bands a few years ago. Thelonious Monster's music is much more melodic than that, and Bob Forrest sings and writes as if part of what he's trying to do is react against both the mindless noise of a lot of hardcore and the straightforward sentiments of LA's establishment rock. Thelonious Monster has a sense of humor. Their debut album 3 years ago was entitled Baby, You're Bumming My Life Out in a Supreme Fashion. And the band also has a sense of place, as you'll hear in this song called Lena Horne Still Sings Stormy Weather. By far the most important new music coming out of the L.A. area is the rap music of newcomers like Eazy-E, Tone Loc, Ice-T, and most amazingly, the group called N.W.A. I played Tone Loc's Wild Thing here a few weeks ago. That song has sold more than 2 million copies, and its follow-up, Funky Cold Medina, is headed for number one. California rap music has been a long time coming, though. In the early 80s, I remember trying in vain to stir up interest in the New York school of rap when I wrote for an L.A. newspaper. People said that in a city where no one walks and everyone rides in cars, there was no street corner scene from which rap might emerge the way it did in New York. Well, as is now clear, Los Angeles car culture has finally inspired its own scene.
In a rap called L.A. is the Place, N.W.A. speaks to this point very directly. Check out the music as well as the rapping, and you'll pick up references to Randy Newman, The Beach Boys, and Grandmaster Flash. N.W.A. and many of the new West Coast rappers come from Compton, a predominantly black city south of Watts. How convincing is their music? Well, just last week, a group of teenagers in Ohio was arrested for merely reciting a few radical N.W.A. lyrics within earshot of some police officers. Times have changed for sure. It's safe to say that nobody ever got arrested for singing a Linda Ronstadt hit.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Cruising down the street in my 6'4", jocking the freaks. Clocking the dough, went to the park to get the scoop. Knuckleheads out there, cold shooting some hoops. A car pulls up, who can it be? A fresh El Camino rolling Kilo G. He rolled down his window and he started to say, it's all about making that GTA. Cause the boys in the hood are always hard. You come talking to trash, we'll pull your car. Knowing nothing in life but to be legit. Don't quote me, boy, cause I ain't said shit.
This is Fresh Air. Urban Edge and Macho Color, nobody tops Lauren Esselman, according to a 1986 Time magazine article on crime writers. Lauren Esselman sets his hard-boiled private eye novels in Detroit, not far from his home on the outskirts of the city. Esselman grew up in Ann Arbor and has always lived and worked in Michigan. Since the publication of his first novel in 1976, Esselman has written 28 books, including several westerns. He's best known for his Amos Walker mysteries. Esselman has a couple of new books. His novel Silent Thunder will be published next week. His new collection of short stories is called Downriver. Here's Esselman reading a short excerpt from his story Fast Burn.
Going to see a private investigator isn't like visiting the dentist. I come at the desperate end of the long line of friends of relatives, friends of friends, and guys around the corner whose friends owe them favors. By the time the potential client gets around to me, he's admitted that his problem has grown beyond him and his circle. So I let this one resign himself to the last stop before the abyss and didn't realize until I looked up again that I was playing host to a dead man.
There's usually a lot of characters at the end of the line in a detective story. Do you think that the detective genre is a good genre for pessimism and hopelessness?
It is that, and I think it's one for optimism, too, depending upon the detective himself. In this case, Amos Walker is a guy who realizes that it's a pretty shabby world, pretty dirty world, and he's just trying to keep his own corner of it clean. So I think he himself represents hope.
Does that describe your temperament at all?
I like to think that, at least on a good day. You know, on other days, I think I'm part of the shabbiness, but I hope most of the time that I'm keeping my corner clean.
Have you or anyone you know ever used a detective?
I never have, and that's a very good question. I've never been asked that question. There's no one I know who has been a client of a private detective. I've known several private investigators, but that's a very good question. I don't think I've ever met anybody, at least no one who ever told me, that they themselves had ever used one.
I guess I find it kind of curious that so many of us are interested in reading detective stories, yet it remains literature to most of us because we haven't had any direct experiences with actual detectives.
That's true. They're there, and every now and then you can pick up the yellow pages and sometimes flip through and come to the investigation section, and you find lists of these people, and you find out that nearly every community of any size has a fairly large complement. So obviously there's business for them out there.
There's lots of competition now in the literary detective world. When you started writing the Amos Walker novels, did you think about how you would want to make him different from the other detectives?
Yeah, kind of. And at the same time, I knew I had a good foundation in that I had never done it. And one writer is different from all the others. No matter how much he might try to sound like the others and imitate his heroes, he's going to sound a little bit different because he's basically a different person. So I knew I had that to fall back on. But also I had the background of Detroit, which at that time had not been used for this kind of thing ever. And it had been used, of course, for police procedurals and crime stories and exploitation novels and movies, but never for the quintessential hard-boiled American private detective genre. So I knew I had those things going for me, and all these things came together. And if he's different, it's because it's a different person writing them from anybody else.
You know the expression that detective novels are about a hat, a coat, and a gun?
I've heard it.
Yeah. Well, I think it was Pauline Kael who said that she thinks they're really about a hat, a coat, and a typewriter, because the detective novels are so much about description and observation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's true?
I think so. And I don't know that they're that different from the rest of literature for that. I do know, too, that some of the best writers working today are working in the detective field for that very reason, because they deal very heavily with the senses, and it's sensory detail that touches people when they read, and the very best writers put you as close to being there as you can possibly be.
I assume that you read some of the other detective novelists who are writing now, and in one of your novels, Sugartown, Amos Walker picks up a detective novel and doesn't much like it. I just want to read what you wrote about that. You write, "There was nothing on television, and I sat up for a while smoking and trying to read a paperback mystery I'd picked up in a drugstore once, tailing someone. It was about a private eye back east who wore expensive running shoes with everything and squawked so much about the things he wouldn't do that you had to wonder what people hired him for in the first place. His partner was a professional killer, and if there was a mystery to it at all, I couldn't find it and gave up. To hell with PIs with codes they have to keep hauling out and looking at like pocket watches, and to hell with cool, fresh voices in women's mouths. They never match the faces. I put down the book." Who were you thinking of when you wrote that?
Oh, I was opening fire on Bob Parker.
I thought so.
And his character Spencer there, obviously. I like Parker's work a lot. I think he's one of the best detective writers working, but I never got close to Spencer. He always struck me as a bully and a snob, and the problems I have with him are the ones that are pretty much laid out there. I worry about a man who says he's honest and then has to remind himself what he has to be honest about. I think that a truly honest man, his honesty is something that's neither spoken of nor even thought of. He must be that way without even thinking about it. So I opened fire on it a little bit. This is nothing new. I understand that Raymond Chandler used to poke fun at Mickey Spillane and things like that. It's a little inside stuff every now and then. I try not to get too carried away with it, but I'm dealing with a character who's existing in something like the real world, so I'm going to deal with some of the competition as well.
Well, one thing Spencer and Amos Walker have in common is that they both like jazz singers and they both like torch singers.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's your taste too.
Yeah, I find that when talking about Walker's likes and dislikes, it's easier for me to give him mine. That way I don't have to go back and check and find out whether or not he likes this or doesn't like
that. You used to be a crime reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Which came first, writing detective novels or being a journalist?
Being a journalist, although I was a journalist by way of becoming a novelist.
Uh-huh.
When I was in college, I was told by one of my mentors, one of my journalism professors in college, that I mustn't count on making a living from my fiction right away, and that I should have something to fall back on. Therefore, I chose journalism, and it was all to the good. Everything I learned from journalism is still doing me good. But along the way, I've written just about every kind of writing that can be done, with the exception of pornography.
And why didn't you try that?
It made me blush. I could not write a sex scene without blushing. I still can't, which is why when I get my hero and a heroine anywhere near a bed, I pan out the window. I call this the Faith Baldwin School of Writing About Sex.
Have you ever been knocked unconscious?
Yeah, once. I used to box when I was in college, oh. and I got a rabbit punch behind the head. And that's what I think I may be, as far as I know, the only working detective fiction writer who has been knocked unconscious, with the exception of Dick Francis, who was once, he once had a horse step on his face, and I don't know another writer who can claim that.
Yeah, I mean, I asked about this because Walker gets knocked out on occasion, and you have to figure out how to describe it.
Yeah, and he gets knocked out enough that I have to describe it different ways, different times. The first thing that happens when you come to after being knocked unconscious is you vomit. And usually in fiction you don't see that, but Walker does do that, or he's fighting it back or something like that. And that happened to me certainly when I came to. It's not a pleasant experience. Sometimes I'll get him through a book without beating him up or drugging him or getting him arrested or hitting him over the head. But at the same time, I don't think he's any more real than he is when something's being done to him. That's the time when you most sympathize with him. But if I did it too much and all the time, then he'd become a figure of fun. But every now and then I feel sorry for him and I let him get through a book without being hit on the back of the head.
I can think of something in common that you must have with the detective that you write about, and that is one of the things he does in the morning every day is check the mail to see if any checks have arrived. And mm-hmm. as a writer, you probably do the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you check, you put the bills in one pile and the checks in another much smaller pile, and that's the way you see how you're doing. You take everything that doesn't say final notice on it and you file it under the blotter.
So how are you doing?
Doing pretty well. I think I'm pretty much keeping neck and neck here.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Lauren Esselman spoke to us from public radio station WUOM in Ann Arbor. His new novel, Silent Thunder, is published by Houghton Mifflin. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. On our program, another discussion about racism on campus at the University of Massachusetts and a talk about social and scholastic separation between blacks and whites on campus there. And also a discussion of Lebanon now entering its 15th year of fighting. The civil war between Christian and Muslim forces began there in 1975. And two Teledyne Electronics executives found guilty of conspiracy. They've been acquitted of bribery charges. The company was accused of paying off a Navy official in order to get some inside information. And on Thursdays, as always, letters from listeners.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Men have performed on stage in women's clothes for centuries. Critic-at-large Laurie Stone has a review of a new kind of drag performance at the Theater Off the Park in New York.
The majority of male drag performers insult women. Danny LaRue, a famous English entertainer, pads himself heavily. For him, femininity is achieved with heroic struggling, and his audience is reassured that men and women are nothing alike. Charles Pierce, another drag performer, advertises his homosexuality by identifying with the women he impersonates, figures like Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, and Judy Garland. He dresses up like these women, but he doesn't like them. He delights in pointing up their egotism, loneliness, and self-abuse. Women represent Pierce's sissy, damaged self. Femaleness is a place to go slumming, and his male gender is never in doubt. But another movement in drag that is friendly to women evolved in the wake of the women's and gay rights movements. This work was best represented by the inspired lunacy of the late Charles Ludlam. Ludlam didn't disguise his gender. For him, the movement from boy to girl was not an arduous struggle or a decadent fall, but a pass through a door to another part of the self. Fortunately, Ludlam left creative descendants, among them Charles Bush, the British satirical troupe Blue Lips, and newcomer John Epperson. Epperson, a.k.a. Lip Synca, is currently staging I Could Go On Lip Syncing, one of the wittiest and strangest shows I've seen in quite a while. Epperson is occasionally accompanied by fanciful, minimal puppets, but otherwise, for 75 minutes, he alone mouths lyrics, dances, and vogues to numbers by showbiz belters like Connie Francis, Nanette Fabre, Anne Margaret, and Pearl Bailey. His one-man show is an exuberant, mesmerizing whole, plumbing and levitating fear of blurred boundaries. Numbers flow into one another, and costumes are changed on stage with a maximum of tease. Epperson's face is made up with huge red lips and eyebrows that zig up, then arrow toward the floor. It's part clown face, part showgirl mask. Epperson's body, which is beanpole thin, skirts gender differences. His form is a hanger on which he drapes ideas, a series of lines he animates into cartoons. The breast portions of his strapless gowns move in one direction, while his flat chest sways in another, the same way that breasts, when they're cast as objects of fantasy, do have lives of their own. Epperson impersonates flamboyant, fame-obsessed divas because their appetites are naked. He revels in trash and recreates the tantalizing state before taste develops. It's a polymorphism where old books are intriguing because they're intelligible, old brands of ice cream delicious because they are sweet, all movies thrilling because they eclipse reality. In this period, boy emotions and girl emotions aren't distinct. Epperson's drag is purposely crude. Kicks are extended without pointed toes. His body is always unpadded. As a man, he resurrects the bliss of dancing in front of the mirror in underwear, a time when anything that feels good can be embraced without moral or aesthetic rationales. Making a spectacle of himself, Epperson becomes lovely, claiming this freedom.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Daniel Waters says when today's high schoolers seem a little depressed, their counselors don't tell them to sit under a tree and maybe read a book. They nervously ask if Johnny has thought about suicide. It's that Morden side of today's high school experience that screenwriter Daniel Waters parodies in his film Heathers. It's a black comedy about high school social life and teenage suicide. On the next Fresh Air, I speak with Daniel Waters about his first film. And jazz historian and bandleader Lauren Schoenberg tells us how Red Norvo forced the jazz world to take the xylophone seriously. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Ed Doherty, Fred Landrell, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.